Today, part two of the story of former Guantanamo Bay detainee Mohamedou Ould Salahi that is now the subject of a Hollywood film and a Guardian documentary that has been longlisted for a BAFTA. If you didn't hear part one, you can listen back. It was out yesterday. Before we start, I'm going to warn you that straight away there is strong language and descriptions of torture that some listeners may find distressing. Yesterday, we brought you the story of how one former Guantanamo Bay detainee, Mohamedou Ould Salahi, was taken from his home in Mauritania, tortured in Jordan and Afghanistan, before being imprisoned in Guantanamo Bay, where he was tortured again.
He starts us beating me. Then they put ice cubes on me so that the beating goes away. Then they beat me again. And this American team, they keep like pouring water over my face, my nose, until I like choke. Yeah, it was horrible.
Mohamedou has always insisted he was not guilty of anything. But after they threatened to hurt his mother, he decided to falsely confess to involvement in some of the world's most shocking terrorist attacks. That made life more bearable for Mohamedou as he was moved to a place called Echo Special, reserved for the highest value detainees. It was there that he met a guard, Steve Wood, and against the odds, they became friends and had moments of laughter that you might not expect inside Guantanamo Bay.
Those are good memories for me. Guantanamo Bay, were like reciting line after line of the Big Lebowski and laughing and singing the songs. Were like, from my perspective, those are like the moments where you could see in his eyes he was happy and able to block everything else out.
When we left off, Mohamedou had concluded that the reason he had been detained by the American government, despite them presenting no evidence and no charges, was simple. There was no one to object.
There was no political cost. There was no human cost. I was a Mauritanian fucking African Arab Muslim. Who the fuck is going to care about me?
But someone did care. In 2005, a criminal defence lawyer named Nancy Hollander learned about Mohamedou's case and decided to represent him.
Literally, it took me about 10 minutes after someone said, if we don't do it, they're going to get bad lawyers. It's up to us to defend the client and make sure that the government plays fair. And I became convinced that we had to do it. We just had to figure out how to do it.
Nancy, who is played by Jodie Foster in the new film The Mauritanian, which is all about Mohamedou's story, had a track record of taking on cases no one else wanted. But few would prove to be as difficult as this one. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, Getting Out of Guantanamo, Part 2. In the film, an intelligence official jokes about Mohamedou being the Forrest Gump of 9/11. The places he'd been, the people he knew, they all seemed to tie him to 9/11 in some way. And just before you went, going into the case, did you have a sense of whether he was innocent or guilty of what he was being accused of?
I didn't know anything. I didn't even know what he was being accused of, other than having some connection to 9/11, which we assumed they all had connections to 9/11 as far as the government was concerned, alleged connections. Most of them had no connections. But I didn't know anything else about him. I barely knew where Mauritania was. You know, I knew it was in Africa. I looked on a map to learn something about it. And then I showed up. You walk through and your bags go through the metal detector and they search you. You put your bags up on a table, you opened it, they looked at it, and that was it. We got our badges, we met our escort, we went to the prison and walked in this hutch. It was not where Mohamedou lived, it was another place. And we walked in and he stood up and put his arms up like around like he was going to hug us, but he didn't move. And we kind of didn't quite know what was going on until I saw the eye bolt connecting around his ankle in the floor. And we just walked up to him and he hugged us and said, "My lawyers." It was a very powerful start to this case. And he had these approximately 100 pages that he had written to tell us something about him.
What was your first impression of him?
That he was smiling. I really don't much remember what we talked about. I'm sure I would not have wanted to talk about anything detailed that first day. I do remember he was very worried that he would be tortured again because it'd only been, about a year since the torture ended. And he was worried that he'd be tortured. He was worried that the interrogators would want to know everything we said. We immediately went back and filed a motion within a day saying that the government had to assure the court that he would not be intimidated in any way or harmed in any way because he had a lawyer.
You said you didn't know what he was even being accused of. How difficult was it to find out and to get the paperwork, the documents you needed to defend him?
It was very difficult to get any documents out of the government. We didn't get anything from the government until 2008, after the Supreme Court decided the case that said, yes, they can file habeas cases and the government has to respond and has to do it timely. But then we had to fight continuously for more records.
I order the prison at Guantanamo Bay closed. And we are doing the hard work of forging a framework to combat extremism within the rule of law. Every nation must know America will live its values and we will lead by example.
How disappointing was it that Obama's promises seemed to evaporate?
Well, it was very disappointing that Obama spoke out of both sides of his mouth. There's an old case in the U.S., Indian case, and in a dissent, a judge said, "Great nations, like great men, must keep their word." And Obama said he was going to close Guantanamo. Obama just thought he could work with everyone and get everything done and should have realized pretty quickly that that wasn't going to happen.
But while all this was playing out, you were defending someone who the American government had painted as a terrorist. Did you come under pressure as a result of that?
I got some letters, I got some threats. Everyone to this day treats the crime of terrorism differently from any other crime. We have plenty of crimes. We have ethnic cleansing, we have genocide, we have rape, we have murder, we have espionage. I represented a man named Wen Ho Lee in an espionage case a long time ago, and I didn't get those kinds of complaints. I didn't get them when I represented Chelsea Manning. That was an espionage case. I didn't get them when I represented somebody who was accused of killing 13 young women and burying them out somewhere in New Mexico. It turned out he was innocent. But I've also represented people who have been guilty, a lot of them. If most of my criminal defense clients weren't guilty, there'd really be something wrong with the system. But, everyone needs, I say this over and over again because I mean it. Everyone is entitled to someone standing on their side, and especially when you have the entire government against you. They always have more money. They always have more time. They always have more resources.
By this time, Mahamudu had been languishing in Guantanamo Bay for years without evidence, without charge, just on the back of that confession that came after torture and that he says was false. It must have felt like you were coming up against a brick wall. Did you think you were going to get your day in court to make the case that there wasn't enough evidence to detain him?
We never knew until we got the hearing in 2009, and that's when Mahamudu testified. We didn't know what the judge would do. The judge had ruled against the other two habeas cases he had. Most of them, you know, people lost, and we had no idea until we got his opinion what it would be.
And his opinion on this issue, which, as you said, is called a person's habeas corpus rights, was that Mahamudu's associations were not enough to make his detention lawful. And not only that, the government's evidence showed he tried to keep his distance from al-Qaeda without making an enemy of himself, and he probably hadn't known about 9/11 before it happened. What did getting that decision feel like?
Well, we felt vindicated, of course. The legal standard was that the government only had to show that it was more likely than not that he had done those things, and it couldn't show it after all those years.
What was it like when you won your case?
This was like I could look my guards in the face and say, I told you, I'm an innocent person, you know. And it was really very like vindicating, honestly. I felt like, you know, I'm a good guy.
Mahamudu Salahi's case was heard at the district court here in Washington. The judge rejected claims that he was part of al-Qaeda and also ruled that association does not prove guilt. But the Obama administration appealed the ruling and Salahi remains in his cell.
And so Mahamudu's relief was short-lived, even though a judge had said there wasn't enough evidence to detain him and he had not been and would not be proven guilty of anything by the authorities. He was not released from Guantanamo Bay. These were dark days for him. Mahamudu had definitely not been proven guilty in any way whatsoever. Why was it another 7 years before he was released from Guantanamo Bay?
The case was sent back to the district court, and the district court did nothing. You know, we went there a lot. Those were years when they really were just social calls, just to make sure he was okay, because there's no other way to communicate with people in that prison. And we'd be watching television, and in the background, he would turn it up louder. And I knew that usually meant he was going to pray. And I would use that as an opportunity to knock on the door and ask the guard to take me out to the latrines, because we drank tea the whole time we were there, too. But I remember being there once and he didn't pray. I mean, I heard the call to prayer, or I knew it was time to pray. And I said, why aren't you praying? And he smiled and said, I'm on a trip. And when you're traveling, you only have to pray twice a day. And I looked at him and said, dude, why aren't you praying? And then he got somber and he said, it's hard to have faith in here. And I knew what that meant, which was he was depressed.
When did you find out that your mom had passed away?
My family did not tell me. They said they did not want to shock me. They want to tell me little bit by little. They called me and they said, your mother, it's very sick. When someone dies, the United States allows you to be called. And I couldn't sleep. I said, why don't you like give her medication? And I felt so helpless because I don't have internet. I didn't have Google to search what type of medication she should take or anything. And then I received a call from my lawyers. They told me your mother died.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
And I didn't know what to do. I was very upset with my family. I wrote them one letter. What says one sentence. May Allah forgive you. That's it. I didn't write anything else. And I sent it to them. I start like praying. You know, it's like a tradition of mine. If someone dies in my family, someone I love, I recite the whole Quran. I sing it without stopping. And the Quran is about 600 pages. And it would take you like about 12 hours. Continuous singing. I sang until I couldn't do anything anymore.
What was your relationship like with your mother?
My mother, you know, she was the tougher guy in the family. I wouldn't blame her. Like after 12 kids,
You know, you deserve a break.
You really do.
I know. You know, this like picture of the mafia guy, very tough. You know, like he would kill over a cup of coffee and is always close to his mother. I understood that because I only knew my mother for real when I got in trouble. Everybody left me. Everybody left me. And I'm sorry to say that, but including also your partner. It's not only me, but I saw other detainees, you know, who were very hurt when their partner left them for someone else, you know, when they went to Guantanamo Bay. But your mother never leave you. And that's, in my life, is a fact of life. That's when I knew the value of my mother.
Mahamadou lost his mother more than a decade after he first arrived at Guantanamo Bay. By then it was 2013, so 3 years after a judge ruled that he couldn't be held indefinitely. And still, that wasn't the end. It was only in 2016 that a review board finally ordered his release. In total, he had been held without charge in Guantanamo Bay for 14 years.
This is a Fox News alert. A federal judge has ordered today the release of a suspected Al-Qaeda organizer, once called the highest value detainee at Guantanamo Bay Prison. National
correspondent Catherine. Coming up, Mahamadou's 14-year nightmare finally comes to an end. Mahamadou, tell me about the day you were released.
You know, I had in my cell, I think a couple of CDs, Two and a Half Men, you know, the sitcom. I kept watching over and over, you know, and the pictures of my family. And then Shakespeare, a book about Shakespeare play. I asked for Shakespeare play. I didn't understand anything, honestly.
It's a certain style.
It's very badly written, by the way.
Some might say that.
It's sat there just for the purpose of, if someone comes to my cell, they would say this guy is very smart. And then this captain, I think she was Air Force captain, I think. She stuck her head inside the bean hole. And I was, oh my God, this is the prettiest face. She was smiling. She said, you know that you are going home? I said, no, I don't. She said, you are. And then the Red Cross came to me. They say, the United States insists that I only go to Mauritania because there were other options like Germany. And I said, yeah, I go back. You know, I was like thinking of this Chris Cagle, Anywhere But Here, the song. Anywhere but here. Of course, the United States wants to keep me under their foot, you know, because their perception that Mauritania would do anything that they ask them. Versus if I'm in the UK, there is the rule of law. They cannot do anything they want to me because I could go to a court and seek relief.
When it was time to finally leave, Mahamadou boarded the plane, shackled.
The trip was so grueling, so painful, because I was trapped in a chair and I have like sciatic nerve. So much pain. But, you know, it was all worth it.
I was waiting for that plane to take off. They were supposed to tell me wheels up so that I could fly to Paris and then fly from Paris to Mauritania and get there shortly after he did. He flew straight across. If you look on a map, Mauritania is just straight across from Guantanamo.
He was being treated as a prisoner when he was on that plane. He was still...
Yes,
he was tied up
yes,
in such a way that he was in so much pain. Like, I just can't get my head around this. Like, he hasn't been found guilty of anything. Why is he still being treated as if he's a criminal?
Because that's what they do. You get on the plane, these are the operating procedures. That's what they were told to do, so that's what they did. Why did they do that? It makes no sense.
When I came to Mauritania, I know it was Mauritania because of the
color of the sky and the heat. The American ambassador stood beside and he didn't say anything. He just went back to his car. And I asked them, I want to say hi to him. They said, yes. And then I went there and I say hi. And he say hi back, we shook hands. I just want to give him the gesture that I hold no grudge against his country or against his people.
You must have held a grudge. I held a grudge on your behalf.
But I don't know, because it's a lot of energy to hold a grudge. No, and I'm a very lazy person.
Mahamadou is home now in Mauritania. He's married and has a young son. But he says he's still not entirely free. His cell is just bigger now. In 2019, Mahamadou finally received a Mauritanian passport, but he is still limited in the travel he can do.
No, I'm not free, because the United Kingdom refuses to allow me to go to the UK.
On what justification?
First, they said, you're Al-Qaeda. And then my lawyer explained to them, he wasn't Al-Qaeda. I went there before even Al-Qaeda was a terrorist organization. And then they say, okay, I don't want to misquote them, but they said, I'm not good to be in the United Kingdom. I'm a danger to their society, which is like very insulting to me, honestly.
What has this case done to your belief in the American system of justice?
Well, I didn't have much faith in the American system of justice before this case. I think that the American system of justice, when it is working the way it's supposed to work, is a good system. I don't know of any that's a better system, but none of that mattered to Mahamadou because they never even had enough probable cause to charge him with a crime. What was the crime? There was never a crime. It's extremely frustrating, but I not only have very little faith in the government, I don't feel protected by the government anymore.
It's been more than 10 years since a court ruled in Mahamadou's favour. A lot has changed in America, and yet Guantanamo is still open. There's still 40 people being held there. As long as it's open, does that justice system remain broken?
Well, the system is broken in many other ways too, other than Guantanamo. But we had hoped that this renewed exposure of Guantanamo will awaken people and the Biden administration to the 40 people and focus on what we can do to get Guantanamo closed, to end indefinite detention, and to provide due process to the people who are already charged. In the U.S., you can be sentenced to life without parole. You can get the death penalty. But that's after you've been charged and convicted, not when the government hasn't even found enough evidence against you to charge you. And these people have to be let go. You either charge them or you release them. End of story.
What does it mean about America that that is not the case? What does it mean that Guantanamo is still open?
To me, it means that Americans have given up caring about treating people correctly. America has seen this monster called terrorism and assigned it to Muslims. That's why it's called Islamic terrorism. We don't call things Christian terrorism when they burn down abortion clinics. In my view, we should get rid of the word terrorism because it always implies something political.
It's not just Mahamadou who is saddled with what he saw and heard and experienced in Guantanamo Bay. Some of the American men and women who worked there, like the guard Steve Wood, who became his friend, are still waiting for their country to take responsibility for what happened. Steve, what do you take from all of this? What do you want to happen?
That was such a small part of Mahamadou's story. Our little side story here is like just one story of Mahamadou's being an amazing human being, you know? That guy's got a huge heart. And there is so much wrong that happened in that place. And it can't happen again, you know? It needs to be shut down and it's it just has to, it has to end, you know? And it's time, you know? I know Obama tried somehow, and that got shut down, and Trump loved the place. But now, you know, now it's, here's Biden's in, and we need to raise hell. But it is well past time for that place, for sure. Because, like, I joined the military. I wanted to get out and be proud of what I did, you know, and a lot of soldiers did. We go to Guantanamo Bay, and I left with no pride. And I kept an innocent person locked up, and like, I got to do my part. I had to make up for that, and that's so my part. I'm going to do all I can, you know, stand by Muhammad Asai and, you know, help him and do what I can to speak out against Guantanamo Bay and get my pride back, you know, and just show him I'm a true friend, you know.
Mahamadou, it feels like this isn't totally over for you. But looking back at the worst period, that 14-year nightmare, what do you want to say to the world?
The United States knew conclusively that I was innocent, but they kept me because they knew I was a witness and I saw stuff I should never be able to tell the world.
That was Mahamadou Ould Salahi, Steve Wood and Nancy Hollander. Now here is an amazing opportunity. You can watch all three of them live together, along with the director of the Hollywood version of this story, the Mauritanian, Kevin MacDonald, and our very own Lawrence Topham, who made a brilliant documentary about Mahamadou and Steve's unexpected friendship at a Guardian Live event on Tuesday the 23rd of March from 8 to 9pm. It's online. It only costs £5 and it's going to be well worth your time. You can book tickets at membership.theguardian.com. Do also watch Lawrence's film, My Brother's Keeper, at theguardian.com. That's it for now. This episode was produced by Courtney Youssef and Sam Colbert. It was exec'd by Mithali Rao. Sound design was by Axel Kakutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. I hope you have a wonderful weekend. We'll be back on Monday.